Hello there. Today is Friday, January 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, growing concerns over national security and air safety as the U.S. government shutdown continues.
Pilots rely on the ATC people to help them out and make sure that they stay safe and that whole plane full of passengers stay safe.
Democratic Republic of Congo inaugurates a new president, and an American rock legend whose celebrity lives on, even though she only lived to be 27. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Venezuela's opposition party continues to push to isolate the country's disputed president, Nicolas Maduro, as an increasing number of countries declare their support for interim leader Juan Guaido Thursday. Guaido, the president of Venezuela's National Assembly, declared himself interim president during a day of mass demonstrations on Wednesday. VOA's Jim Bertel gets a better understanding of the situation with our White House senior correspondent, Patsy Wittakuswara.
Well, yesterday, President Trump tweeted that the citizens of Venezuela have suffered for too long at the hands of the illegitimate Maduro regime. So in that tweet, he essentially recognizes Juan Guaido, the president of the Venezuelan National Assembly, as the interim president of Venezuela. The White House then followed with a formal statement, and not long after that, we saw other countries doing the same thing, including Canada, Colombia, Brazil, Panama, and Argentina. We can also see from the day before when Vice President Mike Pence, in a video, declared support of the United States for the Venezuelan people, especially for the planned mass protests against Maduro. And we also know that since Maduro's inauguration on January 10th, the U.S. and the other countries in the Organization of American States Permanent Council have voted not to recognize Maduro's new term. So there's a gradual ramping up, and it escalated yesterday into this big diplomatic crisis that we are in now.
Well, Maduro has ordered all personnel at the U.S. Embassy to leave the country within 72 hours.
Yes.
The U.S. has said he doesn't have the authority to do that. So how likely is a confrontation between the U.S. and Venezuela?
Well, right now we are in a very fast-moving diplomatic crisis. It's very fluid. Whether or not it would devolve into a military confrontation obviously depends on a lot of factors, and I can't say for sure. But we know that yesterday when President Trump was asked if he was considering military force, he said, we're not considering anything, but all options are always on the table. And he said that several times, all options are always on the table. And I feel that this was somewhat of an escalation from last week when I spoke with a senior administration officials who said that all options are on the table except military. At that time, they were still just considering the economic and diplomatic toolbox, including, you know, more sanctions or oil embargo. And what they're doing now is certainly putting more pressure on Maduro, because now governments and companies and international organizations will channel aid through the National Assembly, which will mean a very big blow to the Maduro regime, because international aid, as you know, is one of its major source of income.
Well, now, whatever steps the U.S. takes will not take place in a vacuum. You've got Russia and China, who are supporters of Maduro. How have they reacted to Washington's moves?
Well, Russia has warned for Washington not to intervene militarily in Venezuela, saying that it would trigger a catastrophe, and Moscow is saying that it would stand with Venezuela to protect its sovereignty. China is also calling out the U.S. to stay out, saying it opposes all outside intervention in Venezuela. And as you know, both of these countries have given the Maduro regime tens and billions of dollars, and they have both invested heavily in Venezuela. And so this is a huge political gamble, a geopolitical gamble for Beijing and Moscow. And analysts have warned that this could be the next hotspot for the world's big players in their quest to expand their sphere of influence.
All right. That's White House senior correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara. U.S. government shutdown continues after the Senate Thursday rejected two bills that would have ended a partial government shutdown. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
One of the bills had the money President Trump wanted for border security. The other did not. The results?
The motion is not agreed to.
Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy says he knows what furloughed workers are feeling.
They're angry. They're confused about why their paychecks are being held hostage.
Maine Republican Susan Collins says this can be worked out.
Can't Compromise is not a dirty word.
She says compromise is a sign of strength.
Let us compromise to reopen government, address border security, and get on with the business of this country.
Press Secretary Sarah Sanders says President Trump would consider signing a short-term bill only if it includes a down payment on the wall. Ed Donahue, Washington.
President Trump did later speak to reporters at the White House Thursday, saying he would accept a deal to at least temporarily reopen the federal government if it contained a, quote, prorated down payment on the U.S.-Mexico border wall he has sought for 2 years.
We have a lot of alternatives. Honestly, we have everybody. Look, for the most part, people agree. When I say everybody, I would say almost everybody agree. We have to have border security. We have to have a wall in order to have border security. You cannot have border security without a wall.
Trump said the country has no choice but to build a wall to keep out what he says is a virtual invasion by criminals, human traffickers, and drugs. Meanwhile, a number of former national security officials, both Republican and Democrat, have written a letter to the White House and Congress warning that the shutdown is a danger to national security and warning the government must be reopened immediately. Joining us to talk about that part of the story is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. How serious of a concern is national security becoming with every new day of the shutdown?
I think it's very serious. It's not so much the funding per se. What it is that people are not working. And when they're working, they're doing significant things. For example, if things with Russia get really serious, what kind of military planning are we doing? If things get serious with China, what kinds of things are we doing in anticipation? I would be really surprised if we do not begin seeing actions by China or Russia to sort of nibble around the edges to see what our reactions are going to be. And so I think it's very serious. And I think what's particularly serious is I'm not expecting a sneak attack or anything like that, but training takes place, and that's not being done. Research and development on weaponry and defensive weaponry is not being done. We're not just talking about federal employees who aren't working. We're also talking about all the contractors. That's very serious. In addition, this sort of thing is demoralizing for workers. Mm-hmm. And I've read articles, I'm sure you have as well, about federal workers now idle who are beginning to look at the private sector. And so I think the combination of these factors is very dangerous. That's 7 weeks. That's a lot of time. Right. Bear in mind that, you know, all of us in various jobs from time to time have been required to work really long hours. But that's not day after day after day after day. You know, you recognize I'm going through this high stress level, but that'll be done in a week or two.
Yes.
This has been going on now for 5 weeks, mm-hmm. and you cannot expect people to work at anywhere near their normal levels of quality. Right. And so, yeah, I think it's incredibly dangerous. But again, this is 1/12 of the year. You just can't lose 1/12 of a year without noticing it.
This whole thing is started because the president is trying to make a case that in order to have national security, we need a border wall. But at the same time, the shutdown seems to be posing an even greater national security risk.
Most people that look at the border issue don't believe that it's an emergency or even a serious security concern. Most analysts think that the bulk of illegal drugs, illegal weapons, and so on, come through airports, you know, come through controlled places, not being snuck across the border between Mexico and the United States.
But then you point back to the air, and we've got the TSA security agents that are in charge of screening,
yes.
that are calling in sick in record numbers,
yep.
and upset and angry and can't pay their bills. And
yep.
I've heard stories of people getting through the lines with things and getting on planes with things they shouldn't be getting on.
Certainly it's troubling on the merits, but personalities have entered it in this dispute in a very large and unwholesome way. The president deciding first that he's going to hold the State of the Union someplace and then deciding not. So clearly there's animus between him and Speaker Pelosi, and I don't think that's likely to help this problem get solved.
How much longer do you think something like this can go on without doing really serious damage to our security, our economy, that could have an impact for years to come?
It is a great question. I read an article that Mr. Mulvaney was talking about agencies making plans for shutdown lasting into March. I find that really, really threatening to our national security and, as you say, to our economy. I don't know what the total number of people who are not getting paid is. I know the government figure is about 800,000, but then there are the so-called Beltway bandits, the various consulting firms around Washington. But then in addition to that are all the merchants who are not getting paid as much as they would if there were not this shutdown. And at some point, that becomes a serious amount of money.
That's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Thanks for being with us. Well, meanwhile, the shutdown is causing air travel concerns. On Wednesday, leaders of the Air Traffic Controllers Association warned that they can't accurately calculate the safety risk at this point. They're urging the president and Congress to reopen the government. This is workers are going without pay or furloughed and are dealing with an already stressful job. They're having to drive Uber, wait tables, and other things to make ends meet. Joining us to talk about that part of the story, New Mexico-based aviation attorney Will Angeli.
You know, it could be. It's difficult to assess how deep the rot, so to say, has gotten. But air traffic controllers, especially around large cities, stay very, very busy and have stressful jobs as it is. And if you start losing a few of them because they don't show up for work or, you know, they have to find other jobs because they can't make ends meet, then, you know, you're down a bunch of people, men and women, that do this every day, and that makes it less safe. But also, even if they show up to work, and they're distracted by the fact that, you know, they may not make their next mortgage payment, mm-hmm. or they can't make a car payment, or they can't make braces payment, or, you know, just the things that ordinary people have to deal with. You don't want an air traffic controller distracted by those things when he's trying to keep planes moving safely through the air.
That is a scary proposition, to think that the people in charge of keeping the airways safe and making sure these planes don't drop from the sky are distracted or tired from a second job, or, like you said, worried and stressed and distracted.
Exactly.
Because of financial problems. They also mentioned that this is impacting, you know, mechanical issues getting fixed and things like that. That's another pretty scary thought.
Well, it is. You know, the FAA has a lot of people who are furloughed right now, and they inspect, you know, a lot of the airlines work that they do, the mechanical work. When they have major maintenance on a plane, they'll need an FAA representative to come sign off on that. And if those guys are not on the job or you know, not able to come out timely because of this whole crisis, then yes, you're affecting safety there. And, you know, also with regard to just, you know, general aviation safety, I mean, the FAA has constantly got its fingers in looking into issues and things like that and issuing warnings where they see them. But if they're not on the job or they're distracted for some other reason, then they're going to miss those things as well. I know the NTSB, which is a different organization than the FAA, a lot of those guys are furloughed and they're not doing aircraft crash investigations right now, or at least as much as they normally do, because they just don't have the manpower and the money.
I guess you can't really gauge whether or not people are at risk if they decide to fly.
Well, anecdotally, I mean, I have flown several times in the past few days. You know, it seems to be fine right now. I think it's, like I say, this is an issue that if it doesn't get fixed soon, I think will become dangerous. It appears that right now the number of workers that they need, that they have, and these people are working without pay so far. And it seems to be a Band-Aid that's working, you know, just over this last couple of weeks. If it goes longer, then, you know, the whole thing's going to rot out, and then you are going to have some serious issues, some serious problems. I think you'll have TSA shut down. Some airports are not going to be able to operate if it goes on for 60 more days or something, because they're just not going to have anybody there to do the work.
Do you think pilots are concerned that they're not getting what they need from air traffic control, given what's going on?
I would be if I were an airline pilot, because they can't see. Airliners are big, but you're not able to see them if they're out far enough, and so you've got to have somebody with a powerful radar sitting in an air traffic control tower telling you, you know, if you've got traffic that's moving in or you guys are on some kind of collision course. I mean, they really heavily rely on ATC. Now, they have a flight plan that they fly, and in theory, if you stick to that, you should be good. But a lot of times, real-world scenarios will come up where they have to adjust certain things, and pilots rely on the ATC people to help them out and make sure that they stay safe and that whole plane full of passengers stay safe.
That's New Mexico-based aviation attorney Will Angeli. U.S. authorities expect to soon hand down a sentence in the case of Maria Butina, the 30-year-old Russian woman now held in a U.S. jail after pleading guilty of conspiring to influence American politics. She's accused of conspiracy and acting as a foreign agent. VOA's Ricardo Marquina Montagnana traveled to the Siberian city of Barnaul to speak with Butina's family about the case that's being watched around the world. Igor Tsikhanekya narrates.
10,000 kilometers from the prison in Virginia, where Maria Butina has been jailed since last June, in the frigid city of Barnaul in western Siberia, her parents and sister gather at the family home. Here, no one doubts Maria's innocence. Her father, like others, believes she was just trying to build ties with Americans.
We find that quite unnatural to accuse a person because of her willingness to see the relations between the two countries as good ones, more friendly. That would be correct, taking into account not quite good relations that presently exist between our countries. Maria has always been willing to see relations of our two countries as friendly ones.
The legal bills are adding up, and the family is having trouble. The political support that they appear to be getting from the Kremlin, they say, does not come with financial help.
My family was quite alarmed by these events, and presently we regularly appeal to the mass media with the request to help us, since the legal support on behalf of the American side, I mean the lawyers, is quite expensive.
Butina studied in this city, and it was here that she launched her political career at the School of Real Politics that trains young people on how to lobby local politicians. U.S. prosecutors say they have evidence showing Maria Butina had contact with Russian intelligence officials. But to her mentor and to Russian public opinion, Maria Butina is a victim of Washington's domestic battles.
I do not think this is an issue of Russia and America. From my perspective, getting deeper into the real politics, this is an internal American issue. In other words, Trump, to put it this way, his entourage and the Democrats.
In Moscow, Butina's case is portrayed as yet more aggression from the West against Russia. In Barnaul, the tensions between Moscow and Washington have Maria Butina's family in limbo. They can only hope to have their daughter home soon.
We so much look forward to it. I do not even know how this first moment will be. We shall certainly embrace each other and probably will cry a bit, but that will be tears of joy, that is for sure.
Maria Butina has pleaded guilty to one charge of conspiracy to influence American politics, and her sentence, like the deportation, is pending. The battle that her case has unleashed between Moscow and Washington has sent a chill through some in this frigid and faraway Siberian city. For Ricardo Marquino in Barnaul, Russia, Igor Tikhanenko, VOA News.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. Syrian pullout pushes Syrian Kurds toward Damascus. Nuclear and climate threats that keep the doomsday clock close to apocalypse. Britain, France back protests against Venezuela's Maduro. And the Senate committee subpoenas ex-Trump lawyer Michael Cohen. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. After a contentious, chaotic election, the Democratic Republic of Congo inaugurated a new president Thursday. Felix Tshisekedi's inauguration, while disputed and controversial, is the first peaceful transfer of power that independent Congo has ever seen. But is it really a new start? Analysts say no. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
All eyes were on Felix Tshisekedi as he was sworn in as new president of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He may have felt the pressure, taking an unscheduled break to leave the stage because he felt, as he said, exhausted by the long election campaign and the emotion of the occasion. But his swearing-in on Thursday represents the first peaceful transition of power in six decades, a historic occasion for a nation long beset by conflict, instability, and brutal politics. On Wednesday, outgoing President Joseph Kabila, who has held power for 18 years, urged the nation to accept their new leader. Tshisekedi's election comes with great controversy. He was declared the winner over objections by opposition candidate Martin Fayulu, who says he actually won the December poll. The influential Catholic Church backed that claim. Fayulu's supporters protested earlier this week after his bid for a recount was rejected by the nation's highest court. Now, as Tshisekedi takes the helm, his critics say they want to see the new president step up. Pro-democracy activist Sylvain Saluseke watched the proceedings from the sidelines in Johannesburg, as his activism has put him in self-imposed exile for nearly 4 years. He said that while he's not entirely satisfied with how the poll played out, he has high hopes for Tshisekedi.
I think he has an opportunity to express himself, at least to show. He has shown in the past that he tends to be conceitual or listen to his buzz, as he call it. If that is the how he's going to run the country, I think he will have to be able to not only listen to as many people as possible, because people will try and control him, but I think he needs to be able to show us that he's a president who can take decisions and stand by them.
But Kabila, who will continue in politics as president of the Senate, may not be far behind. He will be Tshisekedi's biggest challenge, says analyst Stephanie Walters of the Institute for Security Studies.
He doesn't have to cede a whole lot of power. He will become a senator, so he will be influential in the Senate. He will still be the president of the largest coalition, political coalition in the country, with a parliamentary majority and a grip on the provincial assemblies, the 26 provincial assemblies, and on those governors.
Saluseke agrees.
We know that the elephant in the room is Kabila. Kabila hasn't left. And as long as Kabila is still in the country and in the deal, he will still be controlling everything. And that's how we're optimistic about the country, but about Félix Tshisekedi's presidency, he has work to do.
Today, Kabila took a back seat. And with a new president in office, at least some Congolese were in the mood to celebrate. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, after a... you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The 2019 Voice of America calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture the beautiful byways of the United States, including magnificent photos of California's Big Sur Coast Highway, West Virginia's Highland Scenic Highway, and even the Cato All-American Road in Maine. Tune into Border Crossings and call to request a free calendar.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, for hundreds of years, Kayan women in Myanmar have worn coiled bronze rings around their necks, a traditional and customary symbol of beauty. But now a new generation of women from one of Asia's most distinctive ethnic minorities are choosing not to follow in the fashion footsteps of their long-necked ancestors. VOA's Julie Thabot tells us more.
48-year-old Mutu is a Kayan woman from the Kaya region of Myanmar. For generations, women here have worn bronze rings around their necks and other parts of their bodies. Mutu is one of the few women who knows how to make the heavy embellishments and put them on. The shorter sets are easier to make. Everyone has their own preference. So if someone doesn't like what you've put on, you have to take it off and start over. 83-year-old Maria Ken has been wearing the coiled rings on her neck, wrists, and knees since childhood.
I started to wear the rings when I was 8. My dad told me I looked like a boy. He said, so I'll buy you a gun to hunt as a man. But I said, every girl is wearing the rings, so I want to wear the rings too.
Maria has never removed the rings, even when cooking, eating, or working.
It is comfortable. At first it was hard, but now it's fine. I eat and food goes down.
While wearing neck rings was once expected of all Kayan women, more and more have started to shun the practice. Among them is Maria's granddaughter, 20-year-old Zaza U.
They're heavy and uncomfortable. Also, I don't know much about them. That's why I don't wear them.
What is known is that besides extending their necks, the practice crushes collarbones and causes discomfort when swallowing. Even Mutu admits that safety is a concern.
If you don't make the rings correctly, someone can choke.
Whether safety or changing fashion, many young Kayan women are turning their backs on tradition, even as the old ways bring tourists and curiosity seekers.
When I bring the guests to here, I want to let them know the true story of the people in here. So these people is also my people. So why people are calling them as a like a human song, graphic woman, like a Badao. But our original name is Kayang.
Cultural analysts estimate that there are now fewer than 100 long-necked women across the whole of Myanmar, down from about 300 to 400 several decades ago. Some wonder if the tourists will still come to buy their wares when the long-necked women are gone. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train on us feeling near.
Finally today, on this day in rock and roll history, January 25th, 1971, the single Me and Bobby McGee by Janis Joplin was released posthumously. It would be the only big hit the rock, soul, and blues singer-songwriter ever had. Joplin was one of the most successful and widely known female rockers of her era. After releasing three albums, she died of a heroin dose at the age of 27. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdulrahman. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Train all of my tomorrows for one single year.
This is VOA News.